putting restrictions on the travel of human has also put restrictions on the travel and the movement of goods and services.
COVID-19 travel restrictions to the U.S. end. It's Tuesday, November 9th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. You'll also find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, medically assisted dying legal in New Zealand. U.S. workplace vaccine mandate fight. A closer look at China's COP26 statement. Questioning gun use on Hollywood sets in wake of fatal shooting accident. New York City Marathon comeback. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Travel restrictions to the U.S. put in place during the pandemic have ended after more than a year and a half. On Monday, travelers from around the world can resume flights to the U.S. as long as they are vaccinated. The changes will impact travelers from the EU, China, Brazil, and India, among others. VOA's Arash Arabisadi spoke with an economist who explains what this means.
Bhavna Patel has been a grandmother for more than a year. She lives in London, but because of travel restrictions due to the pandemic, she's never met her grandson, who lives in New York. Starting Monday, travel restrictions from Britain and several other countries end for vaccinated passengers. Patel can hardly wait. She spoke from her home with Reuters.
I want to wear a badge. I'm going to see my grandson. I'm going to, you know, I want a big hat or something. I'm going to see my grandson.
Patel is just one of millions of people who were unable to travel to the U.S. for more than a year and a half. The pandemic restrictions have taken a toll on the U.S. economy in more sectors than just travel and leisure. Todd Knoop is a professor of economics and business at Cornell College. He tells VOA travel restrictions had some unexpected effects.
As people have traveled less and traveled more, it's played a big role in influencing energy prices and other prices of raw materials. And that then, of course, filters into almost every aspect of the economy.
Professor Todd Knoop says a strong tourism industry inside the U.S. has kept sectors from struggling as much as in other countries that rely heavily on foreign tourism.
Putting restrictions on the travel of human has also put restrictions on the travel and the movement of goods and services. And so in a increasingly globalized economy, at least an economy that was increasingly globalized up to 18 months ago, that has just led to a lot of, I would say, unanticipated bottlenecks.
Bottlenecks like the backup of cargo ships at the key ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles. Ships wait for days to offload their cargo at the congested ports on the West Coast where most products from China enter the U.S. Knoop says supply chain issues will likely have a bigger impact on the economy than travel as the country heads into the holiday shopping season.
A year ago, it was the travel industry that was suffering, but we had positive effects on the supply side from lower energy. Now we're kind of in the exact opposite situation where higher energy prices and supply chain issues are slowing the economy down. But on the demand side, things are strong.
Still, for travelers like Bhavna Patel, the only news that matters is her upcoming flight.
Like, if I could dance, I would dance.
On Monday, the U.S. will also open its land borders with Mexico and Canada to vaccinated travelers. Arash Arabisadi, VOA News.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. China builds mock-ups of U.S. Navy ships in area used for missile target practice. Top U.S. diplomat calls for return to genuine and inclusive democracy in Myanmar. Experts fear new Hong Kong doxing law will punish opposition. India's latest Zika outbreak sees surge of nearly 100 cases. U.S. envoy starts trip to discuss way forward on crisis hit Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA VOA Asia continues. Medically assisted dying is now legal in New Zealand. The End of Life Choice Act has come into effect 1 year after almost two-thirds of New Zealanders voted in favor of it. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Supporters believe the assisted dying laws will give New Zealanders who are suffering terribly at the end of their lives choice, compassion and dignity. To be eligible, a person must have a terminal illness that's likely to end their life within 6 months. They must also be able to make an informed decision. The legislation came into force Sunday, a year after a binding referendum. Brooke Van Velden is the deputy leader of the small ACT New Zealand party, which promoted the voluntary euthanasia law. She told Radio New Zealand the measures will benefit the South Pacific country of 5 million people.
This weekend, New Zealand became a kinder, more compassionate and humane society for allowing people who are struggling and suffering in those last few days with their terminal illness choice and compassion on how and when they go.
However, some critics insist that patients with chronic conditions might feel obliged to use euthanasia to avoid being a burden on their families. They also believe that inadequate palliative care services need to be better resourced so that terminally ill patients receive better care. Some senior church leaders have said that while they oppose the deliberate taking of human life, they would still offer care and advice to those who chose assisted dying under the new laws. The government has appointed three experts, including a medical ethicist, to monitor the legislation. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said she voted yes in the referendum last year on voluntary euthanasia and the legalisation of recreational cannabis. New Zealand joins a small group of countries, including the Netherlands and Canada, which allow euthanasia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Australia's top diplomat met Monday with Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen on issues including the coronavirus pandemic during the second stop of her four-nation Southeast Asian tour. A spokesman for the Cambodian premier said Foreign Minister Maryse Payne exchanged views with her host on trade and Australia's provision of assistance to Cambodia in the education, health, agriculture, and defense sectors. Payne mentioned during the talks that Australia will provide 3.5 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine to Cambodia, with 1.5 million doses set to arrive by the end of this year, the spokesman added. Australia in February announced a separate grant of $28 million for Cambodia to purchase 3 million doses. Still ahead on VOA Asia, the Biden administration may face an uphill battle on use of workforce mandates to boost COVID-19 vaccination rates. Happening now in Asia, the Taliban-run Afghan Public Health Ministry announced Sunday the start of a four-day nationwide polio vaccination campaign aimed at inoculating children younger than five. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Workplace mandates requiring vaccination against COVID-19 continue to be controversial in the U.S. The Biden administration is expected to respond this week to a recent federal court decision to temporarily halt federal vaccine mandate rules for large employers. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
Around the U.S., the fight over workplace rules requiring vaccination against COVID-19 is heating up. The White House is set to respond this week to a court order temporarily halting a federal vaccine mandate for businesses with more than 100 employees. Some states, businesses, and religious groups sued, arguing the mandate is unconstitutional. The Biden administration argues it is necessary. Dr. Vivek Murthy is the U.S. Surgeon General. He spoke on ABC this week.
There are times where we recognize that our decisions have a broader effect on people around us. COVID has reminded us of that. And that's why having these types of requirements in workplaces will be not only helpful, but it's a necessary step to accelerate our pathway out of the pandemic.
The Biden administration says it's the responsibility of the federal government to create and enforce workplace safety rules. But some lawmakers say the COVID-19 mandate goes too far. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is a Republican. He spoke out against the federal rules.
I don't think people want this decision yanked away from them. I don't think they want to allow a precedent where the federal government could come in and just force you to do what it wants you to do.
With more people signing up to get a shot every day, some question whether the federal rules, which will go into effect in January, are worth the struggle. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, spoke on CBS Face the Nation.
We need to ask ourselves, what is our goal? We vaccinated about 81% of adults over the age of 18. Where do we need to get to, and what price are we willing to pay in terms of cultural divide, acrimony, challenges?
While the number of new COVID-19 cases continues to decline in the U.S., an additional 70,000 cases are being recorded every day. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Be sure to read and see more on this story on VOA Asia Facebook. In other COVID-19 news, the Biden administration is encouraging local school districts to host clinics to provide COVID-19 vaccinations to kids and information to parents on the benefits of the shots, as the White House looks to provide vaccines to those ages 5 to 11. The White House says Biden will visit pediatric vaccination clinics across the country over the coming weeks to encourage the shots. At the same time, Health and Human Services Secretary and the Education Secretary are sending a letter to school districts across the country calling on them to organize vaccine clinics for their newly eligible students. The officials are reminding school districts that they can tap into billions of dollars in federal coronavirus relief money to support pediatric vaccination efforts.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Japanese health officials say the country reported no daily COVID-19 deaths on Sunday for the first time in more than a year. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Chinese President Xi Jinping called on other nations to step up cooperation and act on climate targets, but offered no new commitments in a statement to the UN Climate Change Conference in Scotland, known as COP26. Ralph Jennings takes a closer look at China's statement and plans in this analysis for VOA Asia. In a 500-word statement to the UN Climate Change Conference, Chinese President Xi Jinping said in part, "Visions will come true only when we act on them. Parties need to honor their commitments, set realistic targets and visions, and do their best according to national conditions to deliver their climate action measures." Xi did not attend the talks in person. China, the world's biggest carbon emitter, has been facing an energy shortage that sparked widespread power outages over two-thirds of the country in late September. It was one of China's worst power shortages in a decade. The outages affected factories, leading to concerns about disruptions to global supply chains. China, meanwhile, says it has increased its production of coal, a fossil fuel, to ease the power crunch. Analysts say the Chinese leader's long-anticipated statement shows that China cannot abandon fossil fuels during a power crunch without more infrastructure. Jane Nakano, a senior fellow at the U.S.-based Center for Strategic and International Studies, says households may lack heating, while manufacturing could suffer due to the power shortage.
I am a little disappointed that President Xi Jinping didn't really go ahead and answer some of the key questions that many of us have had. I wonder if the power crunch that China's facing at the moment has really gotten Chinese leadership's way of perhaps wanting to have much bolder commitment.
In his statement, Xi noted an earlier Chinese government plan to peak carbon dioxide emissions before 2030. Last month, China announced a focus on green energy and a new version of its Belt and Road Initiative for infrastructure projects stretching from Asia to Europe. The Paris-based International Energy Agency said while most economies saw a CO2 emission drop of 5 to 10 percentage points in 2020 over recent years, China stood out as the only major economy to log an increase. At previous UN events and in its economic blueprints, China has said it will transition to greener, cleaner fuels while controlling coal consumption. It's aiming for carbon neutrality by 2060. Scott Harold, a Washington-based senior political scientist with RAND Corporation, says China isn't ready yet.
They recognize a desire to shift their energy mix away from coal towards renewables, but in fact, their energy mix keeps shifting the other way because it's really, really hard to do, and they have not invested in or owned the technologies that would enable them to make some of those changes.
Harold says Xi's statement seeks to cast China as a country that has championed a major world ambition after the United States pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord in 2017. At COP26, current U.S. President Joe Biden apologized for his predecessor's decision to withdraw.
I guess I shouldn't apologize, but I do apologize for the fact the United States, the last administration, pulled out of the Paris Accord and put us sort of behind the eight ball.
The U.S. is the second biggest greenhouse gas emitter after China. Last week, President Biden announced plans to reduce methane emissions. The Chinese leader said multilateralism, including UN agreements, is the right prescription for addressing problems such as climate change, which is seen as an existential threat for much of the world. Analysts say it's not clear whether China will make more statements during COP26, which is due to last through November 12th. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in San Francisco for contributing this story. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. Making headlines in Asia, a lawyer for the self-avowed white supremacist who admitted to killing 51 Muslim worshippers at two mosques in New Zealand back in 2019 says his client is considering appealing his life sentence. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the recent fatal shooting accident on the set in New Mexico of Alec Baldwin's movie Rust has prompted calls for a ban on the use of real guns in TV shows and films. Jenny Adulo in Los Angeles spoke with a master armorer who has been in the film industry for over 30 years about safety on movie sets. Here's her report for VOA.
Mike Tristano is what Hollywood calls a master armorer. For over three decades, Tristano has worked on Hollywood movie sets as the person responsible for the safe use of all kinds of weapons used in a film. This is a Colt revolver. It's the same kind of gun used in the shooting accident in October that resulted in the death of cinematographer Halina Hutchins and the wounding of director Joel Souza on the set of Alec Baldwin's movie Rust. Tristano says live ammunition should have never found its way onto the set.
How come those guns weren't checked? I mean, our guns get checked, you know, before they're brought out of the truck, they're checked several times. Then we get them to the set, we check them again. And they're checked usually by multiple armors because usually you're doing a show that's big enough to have at least two people.
On top of that, Tristano adds, guns should have never been left unattended on the movie set, as apparently was the case on the set of Rust. The deadly shooting accident has revived calls for a ban on live ammunition on sets. New York film director Bandar Al-Baloui even posted an online petition that now has over 100,000 signatures.
It's going to end. I mean, yeah, you can make movies that feature guns, bam, 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 your little cowboy movies, but guess what? You're not going to be using real guns with live ammunition.
Film director and producer Russell Duncan, who is based in Los Angeles, says that the second a gun appears on screen, the plotline immediately becomes more dramatic. Yet, despite this effect, he does not use live ammunition.
So I would put the blanks in, like most movies do, put the blanks in and on the computer, on visual effects. So you don't even, you could have an empty gun, a plastic gun, a fake gun, whatever, and the guy could be like this. As long as the actor looks like he's firing, you put the blank there, you know, the CGI effect there, the muzzle flash, and then put the sound in post, and then it looks real.
But Tristano believes computer-generated gunfire negatively affects the quality of the movie.
I don't know how people feel, but I look at that when I see it done, and to me it looks terrible. It looks very fake. The flashes look like photo flashes. The shell ejection doesn't look correct. And on a period piece, I don't care what anyone says, you cannot duplicate smoke from black powder rounds on camera. It looks terrible.
Tristano points out that gun accidents on movie sets are rare, but overall safety on the set remains an issue. The Associated Press reported in 2016 there have been over 40 deaths on Hollywood sets since 1990 and over 150 life-altering injuries. Most are from stunts gone wrong. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, Los Angeles.
In space news, a team of scientists has made the most distant detection of water and carbon monoxide molecules in a massive and ancient galaxy. VOA's Rick Pantaleo has more.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of scientists say they have detected water and carbon monoxide molecules in what is described as the most massive galaxy in the ancient universe. They say their discovery marks the most distant detection of H2O in a star-forming galaxy and that the newly detected molecules also play an important role in the creation of life as we know it. The galaxy is actually comprised of a large and a smaller galaxy, which may merge in the future, and is located nearly 12.88 billion light-years from Earth. This means the scientists were observing the galaxy as it was 12.88 billion years ago, just about 780 million years after the Big Bang. The researchers using the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array in Chile made their findings after conducting an ultra-high resolution and detailed study of the galaxy's molecular gas. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
In other space news, Wang Yaping has become the first Chinese woman to conduct a spacewalk as part of a six-month mission to the country's space station. Fellow astronaut Zai Zigang left the station's main module on Sunday evening, and Wang followed later. The Chinese manned space agency says they installed equipment and carried out tests alongside the station's robotic service arm. The spacewalk lasted until early Monday. The third member of the crew assisted from inside the station, CMS said on its website. The three are the second crew on the permanent station. And the mission that began with their October 16th arrival is scheduled to be the longest stretch of time in space for Chinese astronauts. Three spacewalks are planned to install equipment in preparation for the station's expansion. While the crew will also assess living conditions in the module and conduct experiments in space medicine and other fields, China's military-run space program plans to send multiple crews to the station over the next 2 years to make it fully functional. The world's largest marathon was canceled last year because of the COVID-19 pandemic, so this year's race represented a comeback in more ways than one. 33,000 runners returned to the streets of New York City for the 50th New York City Marathon. With its return, spectators were happy to see the crowds returning. In a city where more than 34,000 have died of COVID-19, organizers hoped for an uplifting celebration akin to the marathon staged 2 months after the 9/11 attacks. VOA's Tina Trin reports from New York. The field was shrunk by about 40% this year to help keep runners distanced, and participants had to provide proof of vaccination or a negative COVID-19 test within 48 hours of race day. Runners registered for the 2020 race that was wiped out.
If there was one word to describe the day, it would be comeback. The New York City Marathon was officially back after the coronavirus pandemic forced its cancellation last year. An estimated 1 million-plus fans turned out to cheer more than 30,000 runners from all over the world as they hit the streets, covering 42 kilometers across the boroughs of Staten Island, Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, and Manhattan. Kenyans took first place in both the men's and women's races. 28-year-old Paris Jepchirchir crossed the finish line in 2 hours, 22 minutes, and 39 seconds, and became the first athlete to win both the Olympic gold and the New York City Marathon in the same year. On the men's side, 27-year-old Albert Carrier finished with a time of 2:08:22, a gratifying comeback after placing second in the 2019 New York City Marathon. But perhaps the biggest comeback of the day belonged to the city itself and to marathon fans who witnessed the return of a New York City tradition known around the world. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Keith Lane, Chris Coscale, Jessica Stone, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. Now go and make it a great day.